Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern science and Noah's Ark right after this. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again, unquote. Well, you know, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's about 286,000 cubic miles of water flow into the oceans every year. Now, for century after century and millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call that the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx of water, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood and its laws are comprehended. Modern science today has now learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. That's the place to begin. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free. It doesn't cost you anything. And you can call and order one right now. Just call and ask for one. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, last time we took up the subject of modern science and Noah's Ark by reading a short treatise from a book called The Harmony of Science and Scripture. The Harmony of Science and Scripture, published back in 1936 and written by a scientist and kind of a theologian combined. His name is Harry Rimmer, R-I-M-M-E-R. You can probably get a copy of The Harmony of Science and Scripture at your local Bible bookstore. Now, I started to take exception with Mr. Rimmer, ran out of time last time, and the reason that I read that section into the record here in the first part of our discussion here of science or modern science and Noah's Ark is because this question of Noah's flood, this issue of Noah's flood, this subject matter, is divided among three groups of people. Three groups. Group A is that group of people that we call scientific, or skeptics, or agnostics, or the irreligious. those people who do not believe in the flood at all. Zero. They don't believe the Bible is true, accurate, and correct. It's just a pile of trash. All right, now that's Group A, commonly known as evolutionists and modernists, and, you know, there's a number of appellations that we can hang on them, but it's that group of people out there, modern yuppie types, you know, that are real smart, educated in college, and have got degrees after their names, and they're engineers and scientists and so on. All right, and then there's Group B. Now, Group B is made up of those religious-type people that believe that the Bible is true, accurate, and correct, and it's absolutely infallible, and would tell you that if the King James Version was good enough for Moses, it's good enough for me. Okay. Now, these are the two groups that are at the opposite poles of the discussion. Don't confuse me with any facts. My mind is made up. Right? So you got evolution on the one hand, and then you got the Bible believers over here on the other. Now, in the middle of this group is the center. In politics, we have the far left and we have the far right. Those are the extremists. And then in the center, we got the group that wants to bring both sides to the table, both sides together. And those are the people that believe in the local flood theory. Those are the people that don't believe God or the Bible is true, accurate, and correct. That the Bible is a good book, and we go to church, and we're nice people. But God has made some mistakes here, and especially in the area of science, which is understandable. God is an old person. And he's not really tuned in to modern technology and modern science, and didn't have at his disposal all of the tools that we have today to explain the natural world and the phenomenon around us. And so God should be very grateful and thankful to us that we've come along to fix his mistakes. These are the mistake fixers over here. And they're led by a fellow by the name of John Pye Smith. John Pye Smith and the local flood theory. He was the guy that came up with the idea. He's a theologian way back in the olden days. He was born in 1774, so you know it was back in the olden days. He died in 1851. And John Pye Smith's long and active life paralleled the entire history of the transition in scientific and theological thought with regard to the extent and effects of the flood. Not only was he alert to the intellectual trends of his day, but he also frequently engaged in oral and written controversy, producing a number of works on theological subjects. And toward the end of his teaching at Homerton College in London, Smith became enamored in the new science of geology, and he began to give lectures on the harmonization of Genesis and geology. And according to one of his biographers, relying on evidence, this is Smith now, he's relying on evidence, the only valuable ally in scientific investigation, our author arrived at the conclusion that the Noachian deluge was not and could not have been universal, and that the affirmation could not be maintained except by the wretched subterfuge of supposing a stupendous miracle throughout the whole continuance of that deluge. All right, so that's John Pye Smith. That's the middle ground. And Harry Rimmer, who I have great admiration for and great respect as a scientist and as a believer in Scripture and as a teacher, has subscribed to that middle ground philosophy. And many people have, and I'm not here to argue with people's beliefs now. But I want to take a look here at the facts, and I want to apply standards, scientific standards, to these facts to arrive at a conclusion. Remember, I'm an investigative reporter, and I don't deny now that I have my opinions and I have my beliefs. I'm not here to argue with you that, well, you know, you're not perfectly, you know, objective about this. Then you're exactly right. And when we apply science to a subject and we start discerning facts and we apply the scientific standards to those facts, when I applied the rules of evidence that we use in court, now remember, as a lawyer, I want to apply some kind of standard, an objective standard that we can all agree upon. So all of you lawyers out there probably understand this thing called the rules of evidence. What would happen if we applied the rules of evidence to the narrative in Genesis 6, 7, and 8? What do you think would happen? You know, law is a science. I don't know if you understood that or not. We have a doctorate. We call it the Doctor of Jurisprudence. And we graduate people from college. We have judges that sit on our judicial benches in our judicial process. And then we listen to controversies. And then we arrive at a conclusion. We have to have some kind of an objective standard that we apply, and we call that the rules of evidence. We have some techniques that we use, like cross-examination. If we applied the 23 rules of cross-examination, or the 23 techniques of cross-examination, to this narrative in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, what kind of a conclusion would we come to? If we applied the rules of evidence to Genesis 6, 7, and 8, what kind of a conclusion would we come to? Would it be that the flood was local or worldwide? That the narrative is true, accurate, and correct, or that it's false and it needs correction, or that it's partly true or partly false, or some combination thereof? All right, so in doing that, I took a look at Genesis 6, 7, and 8, applied the rules of evidence that were compiled by Simon Greenleaf. I'll tell you a little more about him in a minute. And I came to the conclusion that, after counting them up, looking at Genesis 6, 7, and 8, there are 48 reasons to believe that the flood was universal, and that there are zero reasons to believe that it was local. Applying the 23 standards of cross-examination and the six rules of evidence, or the six standards of evidence. So let's take a look here, first of all, at the standards that we're going to apply to the problem. Get your pen and paper out here, boys and girls. For those of you that have your minds made up on one side of the issue or the other, just sit back and relax. Or turn the dial on the radio and get something more intelligent to listen to. No point taking a lot of time, effort, and energy trying to show you something that you don't want to hear. I don't want to rain on your parade or spoil your day. Now, for the other four or five of you out there that are sitting there saying, well, I wondered about that, and I'm kind of curious, and I'd kind of like to know what the standards are, get your pen out there. Get your pencil out there, sharpen it on both ends, and see if you can get this down. Because I think that we can prove that the Scripture is, in fact, true, accurate, and correct, and the flood was universal. I think we can do it scientifically, because the Bible's a science book. Now, I know that you went to church one day, and your preacher, he was making excuses now for the Bible, and he said that the Bible is not a science book. I heard that same story. See, I'm not deaf, dumb, and blind here, you know. I heard that. But I, one day, picked up the Scripture. Now, there's 1,189 chapters now in the Bible. I don't know if you knew that or not. There's 66 books. They're arranged in 1,189 chapters. And so I started out in Genesis 1. I finished up over here in Revelation 22. And when I got all done looking at it, I said, you know, there's a lot of science in here. In fact, I just told you in this morning's opening, I said, you know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea isn't full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. That's a scientific statement. That's science. That's meteorology. right out of the scripture. And that statement on meteorology is as accurate today as it was the day Solomon penned it. It's absolutely true, accurate, and correct. The Bible is full of science. The atomic theory is revealed in the scripture. Another one here. I told you this one yesterday. The spectroscopic analysis of the matter that we see from the universe was first written in Job 38, verse 24. Spectroscopic analysis was first revealed closer to 3,500 years ago by Job in Job 38, verse 24. I would submit to you that spectroscopic analysis is pretty damn scientific, wouldn't you? Now, in spite of what your preacher told you, he lies a lot. Preachers are nice guys, and they've got a good bedside manner, but they lie a lot. Now, if you want to excuse your preacher, it may be that he's just ignorant, in which case he shouldn't be a preacher. I don't know whether your preacher is just ignorant, stupid, or a damn liar, but you know. Whatever you've been hearing out of this guy when he told you that the science is not a science, or the Bible isn't a science book, you know, tain't so. And as old Mark Twain used to say, there's liars, damn liars, and then there's statisticians. So let's start by looking at this thing here from the perspective of Simon Greenleaf. Now, Simon Greenleaf wrote a short book, and I'll just tell you how many pages it is, 128 pages. And then the title of the book is called The Testimony of the Evangelists. And he takes on a section of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and applies the six rules of evidence and comes to a conclusion by analysis. So he wrote up 47 questions, 47 questions that needed to be answered. And then he answered them by the rules of evidence and applied the rules of evidence to the four Gospels and then came to a conclusion that their testimony was true, accurate, and correct. And here's 47 reasons why that's true, accurate, and correct. Now, who is this guy, Simon Greenleaf? Simon Greenleaf was born in 1783 and he died in 1853. And he was born in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and he began the practice of law in Portland, Maine. He served as professor of law at Harvard University from 1833 to 1848, and he was instrumental in organizing the university's law program. His three-volume work, A Treatise on the Law of Evidence, is considered a classic of American jurisprudence, and it forms the basis for his study of the four Gospels. Now, here's a lawyer. Now, this is a rare lawyer. This is a lawyer that takes up the scripture and then analyzes it and comes to a conclusion. He says, I think that these four books, the four Gospels, are true, accurate, and correct. Now, there's another guy weighs in on the subject matter over here, and his name was Ivan Pannon. Ivan Pannon, also a scientist. You ever wonder about science and scientists and what that means? Because oftentimes we hear the term science and scientist applied to evolutionary philosophy. You know, science tells us that we evolved from green algae. Like the preachers out there, that's a damn lie. That isn't true at all. That ain't the way that works. You know, I don't deny you believe it, but I'm just telling you it ain't so. And it ain't the first time you've been deceived, and it won't be the last. And so, if we want to find out, well, how did that game get played anyway, then it's necessary for us to investigate. Now let's take a look at this for ourselves. It's time to quit listening to the theologians and time to quit listening to these pseudoscientists. Now, I'm not opposed to science now. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. The Bible is a science book, and the Bible has got some real science. And then there's some guys that run around out here that call themselves scientists, and what they really are is theologians. See, they're really religious guys. And they're peddling their religion, and their religion is evolution. And these evolutionists over here have faith. Religion is based upon faith, and they don't deny it. I mean, hell, you just go to any church anywhere, and they'll talk about faith and believe. Just you believe. Do you believe? You know. And all of us have beliefs. I'm not opposed to somebody having a belief, but, you know, is this belief true? Did that really happen that way? Is that the way that was done, or is this just your belief? This is just your theory, your understanding. So if we apply some standards, let's take a look here at the word science over here. Science means knowledge. God, the Creator, the guy that wrote the Bible, he's not opposed to knowledge. In fact, he puts knowledge in a context over here, and he says you ought to seek knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. You see that in Proverbs chapter 1. He gets right after it. He says, you know, if there's something that you really need in life, it's knowledge. He made another statement one time over in 2 Chronicles. He says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Well, you know, we all go to school here in the West. Can't speak for everybody in the world, but you know, you talk about Europe now and the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. By God, you know, we're all educated. We have to go to school whether we want to or not. So we're all educated. Now, as to whether or not we're all educated in the truth, that's another subject. We go to school and we develop beliefs. And then we go out into the marketplace and we apply those beliefs. And then sometimes they're true and sometimes they're false. And sometimes there's a combination of the two. But here's what a scientist is, you know. Science. Science is knowledge made up of an ordinary system or an orderly system of facts that have been learned from study, observation, and experiments. Study, observation, and experiments. And science helps us to understand and to control the world that we live in. And a branch of this knowledge, such as the science of astronomy, skill or ability, such as the science of boxing. Okay, so we're dealing with skill or ability, and we're dealing with a branch of knowledge. And we're dealing with knowledge that's made up of an orderly system of facts that have been learned from study, observation, and experiment. So, you know, if we're going to do something here, we're going to come to a conclusion, and we want to call it scientific. We need to be able to experiment with this thing and duplicate it and make this thing work. Now, scientific means having to do with the use or used in science. It's a scientific study. Scientific equipment, using the rules and methods of science, scientific procedure, skillful or highly trained, such as a scientific boxer. And then there's a scientist. He's an expert in science, such as a chemist or a biologist, or a lawyer. A lawyer is an expert in science. Now, sometimes we deal with a thing here called the art. Art. Science is knowledge, but an art is something different than science. It's also a skill. We have a fellow that's called an artist, and he can depict, he can paint a picture. It doesn't mean that the picture that he's painting is necessarily true. But he can paint a picture, and then you can see it, and the picture is worth 1,000 years. And the picture may be true or it may be false. For instance, he could draw a picture of a Leviathan or a Behemoth, both mentioned in the Bible now, by the way, Leviathan and Behemoth. He could draw a picture of that. That's an artist's conception, which in all probability has very little to do with what a Leviathan or a Behemoth actually looked like, if we actually had a picture of one in true life form. But we have imagination. So art deals with imagination. It's what you believe. And much of what goes on in life is really art. It doesn't have very much to do with science. It has a lot to do with art. Evolution has a lot to do with art. I know when I go to the science museums and I travel to the various and sundry parks, and we look at the explanations in the cases and the murals that are drawn, like the depiction of prehistoric life. There's no science involved there. It's all art. It's all imagination. Billions and billions of years ago, thus and such occurred. And they tell a story and show you with pictures and artists' conceptions. And oftentimes, we see Noah's Ark. Have you ever seen artists' conceptions of Noah's Ark? Noah's Ark is always a little bitty boat with great big animals around it. And when you're looking at a Noah's Ark by an artist's conception, you've got elephants, rhinoceros, hippopotamus, and giraffes. I mean, the biggest animals that we know of on the planet are standing on Noah's Ark, which is obviously so small that if in reality those animals were standing on it, it would sink the boat. Every single time. Every time. That's art. But art is very, very persuasive because you develop your beliefs based upon your five senses. What you believe about Noah's flood came into your mind through your five senses. You had to see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, or hear it, or you couldn't know it. And your power of sight is a very powerful persuader. So when you look at this picture, it's kind of a cartoon. Almost always these are cartoons. You see a cartoon of this little bitty ark with these great big animals, and that tells you something. And the first thing it tells you is the ark wasn't big enough for all those animals. And we covered that in the last program. And Harry Rimmer covered that very adequately. And so the first thing we need to do when we take a look at the Bible is to apply the rules of evidence to it. And let's see whether or not these rules of evidence, when we apply them to the testimony that we're listening to, and then we apply the rules of cross-examination, and then we come to a conclusion, is this narrative credible? Is it truthful? Is it, and does it represent the fact? As opposed to what we believe. Now, I don't care whether you're an evolutionist or a high school science teacher or you're a real religious person over here. You have beliefs. We all do. It's just part and parcel of being human. You know, you've got a belief. So the first thing we ought to do as a lawyer, now, you know, we're in the courtroom now, and we're going to apply the rules of evidence, the Kwok Ting test, cross-examination. And then we're going to apply these rules and find out whether or not this testimony is true, accurate, and correct. Now, for most of you people out there that are not trained in law, there's a secret here. I'm going to let you in on the secret over here. If you come into court and you lie, we have a test that we can apply to your testimony, and we can determine whether or not you're telling the truth or not. I don't know if you knew that or not, but this is a secret called the Kwok Ting test, which is published. I mean, it's not some super secret that you get out of the Masonic order that you can only pass on by oral tradition and that only the adepts can hear. I'm not talking about that, not at all. These are rules, laws, guides. We teach these to law school students. All of you lawyers out there, every one of you judges understand this, the Kwok Ting test. But all of you lay people out there who have not been through the law school experience, you do not know how we lawyers and judges determine whether or not you're telling the truth. Now, I'm telling you that every judge in America, well, I shouldn't say every judge because there's some dummies out there, but I'll put it this way. Every federal judge in America understands this, and most of the state judges do. If you're a justice of the peace elected by the people and you're a lay judge over there, you probably don't understand this, but all of the judges trained in the law schools do. And there's a modality, there's a methodology that we use in order to determine whether or not your testimony is truthful, and we can demonstrate it and we can document it by the use of cross-examination. So let's just test that, the rules of evidence, when we come back. Now, I say when we come back, because now I've got to get my, where it is right here. I guess damn many papers here on my desk, I can't find my script. Turn to page 2 here of the script. All right, listen to this. You are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in the world, around the world, in 120 countries that we know of, 120, daily, over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this radio network, or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of modern science and Noah's Ark, okay, or the deluge or the worldwide flood. You know, we could hang 55 different labels on here, but I thought, well, we'll start out here. Let's take a look at Genesis 6, 7, and 8, and let's apply some standards that are well-known and well-used in the judicial process. Let me flip over here to Greenleaf's book. Now, remember, Greenleaf, Simon Greenleaf, is a law school professor, an old, old-timey law school professor, and he's one of the guys that formulated and wrote up these standards, these tests that we apply to see whether or not you lay people are telling the truth. Now, of course, all of us lawyers out here, we're skilled professional liars. I was asked that one time. I was in court, and the judge said, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?" And I was a witness in this particular episode, and so I paused for a little effect, and I said, "No, sir." And I don't think, this judge's name is Judge Grant, I don't think old Judge Grant had ever heard that statement before at the end of his, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, say up to God? And the witness says, no, sir, I don't. And he got a little perturbed. He's a Mormon judge, you know, and he takes oaths. And so he repeated it. He said, now, Mr. Gordon, you have to take this oath in order to testify. I said, okay. And he said, now, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He couldn't contain it. He said, why? And I said, because I'm a liar. You ever heard a witness ever get up there on the witness stand and somebody's trying to ask him, you know, it's a question. Think about it now. This is a question. Do you swear to tell the truth? No, I don't. The whole truth? Nope, not at all. And nothing but the truth? Can't do that. So help you God? No, sir. And then answer the question, no. See, everybody stands up there. They got their hands up in the air and they got their, you know, kind of like they're appealing to God. And then, oh, yes, I'm going to tell the truth. I ask students here when they come into class, how many liars do we have in here? Nobody volunteers. They don't raise their hands and say, yeah, I'm a liar. I ask people, are you a communist? Nobody volunteers. They'll look at you like you're Mork from Ork. I haven't had a student come in here yet that wasn't a practicing communist. Every single one of them. Typically they are, or at some time in the past they were. I was a communist for many years. Well, until I was 37 years old, I was a communist. I was trained in communism. I'm a paid professional communist. So anyway, this judge, he asked me why, and I said, well, because I'm a liar. Now, think about that for a second. If I said to you, I am not a liar, what would you think of that? Now, in the Bible, there's a statement written by the Apostle Paul that said, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. I read that one time, and I said, Now, most men do not want to be looked upon as being liars. I'm sorry to report to you that I am one of those. You know, so if you were looking for some truthful, honest guy to come on the air and just disseminate the truth to you, you got the wrong radio program here again. You need to get somebody else, some truth teller out there. So, bottom line to this is I took a look at that statement in the scripture that says, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. And I said, gee, am I a liar? Now, sometimes I tell the truth. I don't deny that. Once in a while it happens. But oftentimes I discovered this. At some time in the past, I told a lie. I know it was a long time ago, but a long time ago, I told a lie to my teacher in the fourth grade or somewhere along the line. That establishes that I was a liar in the past. Recently, I told a lie. Not a very big one, just a little white lie. But recently, I told a lie. So that's present. So I'm a liar past and I'm a liar present. I suspect, as old as I am, but I do suspect that before I die, I will lie one more time. Now, that's only three lies in a whole lifetime, but it demonstrates that I was a liar in the past, I'm a liar today, and I will probably be a liar in the future. That tells me it's pathological. Pathological. I told the judge that one time. I said, well, I'm a pathological liar. He said, well, that ought to screw you out of testifying in court. I said, well, I hope it does. I didn't come in here to testify. You brought me in here with a subpoena. I didn't walk in off the street and say, gee, fellas, could I get up on the witness stand, swear an oath, and testify here today? So, just for your information, you know, you're listening to a liar here. Now, in order to understand this concept of lying and telling the truth, and I'll pass another little piece of information off to you. These are secrets now that you lay people out there aren't supposed to know. And that is, 75% of everything that you know, or think you know, or hope to ever know, is probably true. at 75%. That's the good news. Okay. Now, 25%, that's the balance. Okay. The rest of everything that you know, think you know, or hope to know is false. Now, here's another little secret. 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. Did you know that? That was Professor Swift, discovered that back in 1918. Now, we who are in the legal business or the legal profession, we know that, see, and we deal with that every day. We deal with people who get up on the witness stand, raise their hands to God Himself, and swear to tell the truth, and then proceed to lie to us. Here's a curious factor. These people who have just sworn to tell the truth, honest to God, believe that every word coming out of their mouth is, in fact, true. And one guy comes in, he testifies the green car hit the red car, and the next guy comes in, testifies the red car hit the green car. Now, it's obvious. We get two eyewitnesses here, and one says it was the green car that hit the red car, and the red car hit the green car. You know, one of these guys ain't telling the truth. Which does not mean that the guy is deliberately lying, trying to deceive us. From his vantage point, that's what he saw. That's what he believes. That's what's in his brain. So if you believe in evolution, I don't doubt that. If you believe in Jesus, I don't doubt you a bit. But, you know, are your beliefs, is what it is, between your ears, is that really true? Did that really happen that way? Is Noah's Ark really depicted correctly by picturing a little tiny boat with great big animals on it that would sink in reality if that was ever put in the water? And you know, if that's your concept of it, fine, you're entitled to your beliefs and concepts. Hell, I'm not here to tell you what to believe. I just thought I'd throw this out. As an investigative reporter, is this really true? Did you want to believe this because it's true, or did you want to believe it because it makes you feel real good? I don't know. It's your choice, you know. All right. So now, based upon the fact that scientifically tested, now let me show you how we scientifically test this. We take you, along with a group of people, students in a class, we take you out on a field trip, and we set up two video cameras so that we get the events that are going to transpire for the next 60 minutes. We're going to get these on videotape. Okay? It doesn't have to be a 60-minute test, but the one I'm relating to you happened to be a 60-minute test, so I'm going to describe it for you. And in this 60-minute test, we sit you down with a yellow pad and a pen. You can take all the notes you want. In fact, as an instructor, we encourage you to take notes because we're going to debrief you after these events have transpired, and we want to test you and see how well you can observe things and remember things and then come back and testify to these things that you've seen as an eyewitness. We're testing your powers of observation as an eyewitness, and then we're going to show you that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is a damn lie. How do you like that, huh? This is science at work. And we can do this over and over and over again. We can demonstrate it. We can test it. This is what science is all about. So, then we're going to apply this test to the writers of the scripture. And we're going to see, well, how do they come out? How do you like that test? We're going to apply some science here to the Bible. We're going to put God's feet to the fire and see whether that sucker's lying to us or not. We can figure this out. Now, the next step here, you're sitting here at a park bench, and this one here is taken at a lakeside, close to a dock, and two couples with two children each are the subject matter of the observation. They have a boat, and they're on a picnic, and they spread out their blankets, and they have a picnic table there, and they have a boat there, and they have water skis, and they go water skiing off of the boat and off of the shore, and this goes on for an hour, and there's four children and four adults. There's two women, two men, and four children. And this event goes on, and these two cameras are photographing these events now from two angles, and you're sitting there observing this, and you watch the boat take off, and somebody is water skiing, and somebody they come back, and then they have some hamburgers, and then they... And after they get through with lunch, they go water skiing again, and then there's some play with a volleyball, and, you know, things are going on. All right, now, 60 minutes is up. We shut the cameras off, and we say, thank you very much. It was good having you here today. Okay. Now, we let you wait 7 days, and we come back. Well, wait a minute. We start off. First of all, we debrief you immediately. We give you a 100-question test. I'm going to get ahead of myself here. Right, is as soon as you get through watching these events, we give you these 100 questions, and we test your memory. And then we take those answers over here. Now, you've got your notes now. All we wanted to do is let you watch this. Now, we've got everything that actually happened on videotape, see? And then we're going to ask you these 100 questions immediately after the event. And then when we get through, we then... excuse you. And then we bring you back 7 days later and we ask you the same 100 questions. And you give us your answers and we put that down. We come back 30 days later and we ask you the same 100 questions. And we take your answers and we take those. And then we come back 6 months later and we ask you the same 100 questions. And then we come back 1 year later and we ask you the same 100 questions and you answer all these questions. Then we put these tests. That's a week, immediately after, a week, a month, 6 months, and a year. And we put these five tests together now. And we find that there are discrepancies. Discrepancies, such as, you know, but not limited to. We ask you, what color was the boat? Immediately after the event transpired, you said it was blue. A week later, you said it was dark. A week later, you said it was black, or a month later. And then 6 months later, you know, maybe in your case, you said it was blue, and 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 you said it was blue, okay? And so you were consistent. But here's what we discover. We discover that immediately after the event transpires, 25% of your answers are incorrect. 1 week later, it's still about 25%. A month later, it grows to something more than 25%. At the end of 6 months, it's 50% incorrect. Listen to this. 6 months after the event transpired, testing your memory now, just testing your memory, 50% of your answers will be incorrect. Now, at the end of 1 year, the incorrect answers do not increase over 50%. They still stay right at 50%. 10 years from now, 20 years, 30. So if you had an event that occurred back in your childhood, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, listen, today you have those memories in your mind and you believe those memories. But if we had a videotape of the event that transpired 30, 40, 50 years ago, 50% of your memories are incorrect. And that tells us one very valuable thing. Eyewitness testimony is the least reliable testimony that we can apply in court. Eyewitness testimony is the least reliable. So when a witness comes in and says, I'm an eyewitness and I saw this happen and that's the guy that raped me over there, you shouldn't be surprised that 30% of all rape convictions are false. False. If you're sitting in prison right now today, convicted of rape, take 100 of those guys, 30 of them are innocent. Now, we know that. You know, we believe that they're guilty. We convicted them and threw them in jail. But they aren't. 30% are innocent. And we know that because we take samples every once in a while of DNA, and we find out that lady lied when she said, that's the guy that raped me over there. Now, she might have believed that. I'm not saying that she committed perjury now. She probably believed that that guy sitting over there in the defense chair was the guy that raped her. And she said, that's the guy that raped me. But then, you know, when we put some science behind it and we take the semen test, you know, and we apply the DNA test, you know, we find out, no, that's not the guy that did it at all. We don't know who did do it, but now we know who did not do it. And, of course, it's always helpful if we could get this evidence out up front at trial rather than after this fellow's been in prison for 10, 20, or 30 years. You know, it's better if we could find this out up front, don't you think? All right. Now, these events that transpired back here thousands and thousands of years ago, we can still apply these same rules of evidence. I mean, we've got the testimony. We've got the record. We've got the transcript. Now, can we take this transcript after the fact and apply these rules of evidence? Now, get your pencil out here. Let me tell you what these are. Number one, we have what we call the ancient documents rule. And that is, every document, apparently ancient, coming from the proper repository or custody, and bearing on its face no evident marks of forgery, the law presumes to be genuine and devolves on the opposing party the burden of proving it to be otherwise. That's called the ancient documents rule. So we have an ancient document here called the Bible, applying the ancient documents rule. If the book of Genesis, chapter 6, 7, and 8 is in the proper repository, we presume it to be true, accurate, and correct. And the burden of proof shifts now to the opposing camp. Okay? Now, let's try number two. In matters of public and general interest, I would suggest that Noah's flood is a matter of public and general interest. All persons must be presumed to be conversant on the principle that individuals are presumed to be conversant with their own affairs. Their own affairs. Take a look here at another one. I'll flip over here to page, here we are, page 31. The credit due to the testimony of witnesses depends upon, firstly, their honesty. Secondly, their ability. Thirdly, their number and the consistency of their testimony. Fourthly, the conformity of their testimony with experience. And fifthly, the coincidence of their testimony with collateral circumstances, which is also known as the Kwok-Ting test. Now, in the absence of circumstances which generate suspicion, every witness is to be presumed credible until the contrary is shown. The burden of impeaching a witness's credibility lies on the objector. Now, the proposition of fact is proved when its truth is established by competent and satisfactory evidence. Competent and satisfactory evidence rule. In trials of fact by oral testimony, the proper inquiry is not whether it is possible that the testimony may be false, but whether there is a sufficient probability that the testimony is true. It's called beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Okay? Now, there's your six rules. I'm going to run those by you one more time so that you can kind of get this in your mind here a little bit. It's called the ancient documents rule. Every document, apparently ancient, you know, apparently ancient, coming from the proper repository or custody and bearing on its face no evident marks of forgery, the law presumes it to be genuine and devolves upon the opposing party the burden of proving it to be something other than that. In matters of public and general interest, all persons must be presumed to be conversant on the principle that individuals are presumed to be conversant with their own affairs. And the credit due to the testimony of witnesses depends upon five standards. And they are, first, their honesty. Second, their ability. Third, the number and consistency of their testimony. Fourth, the conformity of their testimony with experience. And fifth, the coincidence of the testimony with collateral circumstances, also known as the Kwok Ting test. Okay? In trials of fact by oral testimony, the proper inquiry is not whether it's possible that the testimony could be false, but whether there is sufficient probability that the testimony is true. And a proposition of fact is proved when its truth is established by competent and satisfactory evidence. And in the absence of circumstances, this is number six now, in the absence of circumstances which generate suspicion, every witness is to be presumed credible until the contrary is shown. The burden of impeaching his credibility lies upon the objector. All right. Now, with those six standards in mind, we have what we know here, what we call the Kwok Ting test, discovered by or put out by the Supreme Court back in 1891 in the case of Kwok Ting versus California. I believe that's what it is. Now that's Kwok Ting versus United States, and it's cited at 140 U.S. 417, decided on May 11, 1891. So jot that one down so that you can get the Kwok Ting test here, because we're going to apply these tests and these rules of evidence to this narrative, to this testimony given by the narrator here in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. We're going to test this sucker's credibility and see whether or not he's lying to us. Number one, the testimony must be complete. So when we look at Genesis 6, 7, and 8, the testimony that's given has to be complete. Number two, the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. Extemporaneous detail. And number three, the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. Are there any witnesses to this transaction? Is there any evidence? Do we have extemporaneous detail? Do we have a complete story? Because if we do, then we've got something here that we can test. How do you like that? Now, there's also 23 cross-examination tests that we use. It's humor, details, collateral matters, memory, an expose, the demonstration, flattery, confrontation, memorization, contradiction, inconsistency, explanation, embarrassment and ridicule, the test, the hypothetical, overconfidence, many witnesses, the trump card, the high point, silent cross, eyewitnesses, the power of suggestion, friendly and impartial inquiry, and partisanship. Hey, boys and girls, we're not powerless here. We've got science working for us here. We can apply the science of jurisprudence. Hey, we've been around this ring before. We know how to determine whether or not somebody's lying to us. Now, the average layperson doesn't know that, but there isn't a judge in America on the federal bench that doesn't know that. And there aren't very many lawyers that don't know that. Well, there's a few, you know, but there's not a whole bunch. Now I'm running out of time here again, kids, so we're going to have to leave it right about here. And we'll come back next time, and we'll take up the subject of modern science and Noah's Ark, and we're going to take a look at these 48 reasons why Noah's flood, the narrative in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, is true, accurate, and correct. Or it's as phony as a $3 bill. So let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. All of these law hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time. same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.